We must understand that the Holocaust is not only about 6 million Jews that died. The Holocaust was loss of dignity. Holocaust was humiliation. Holocaust was loss of education. Holocaust was confiscation of property. Holocaust was about enslavement. Holocaust was about starvation. Holocaust was about torture. Holocaust was, of course, about mass execution. And finally, extermination. I was born in Slovakia, and therefore I will speak about my experiences. I'm a survivor of the Holocaust, and I will speak about how I survived. I remember my childhood in a little village in Slovakia. It's about 700 inhabitants. My father was a farmer, and I remember the children of the village would come to the yard and we used to play. My father was in the Slovak army. We lived for a generation in Slovakia. But in 1941, when Germany invaded Sudetenland, annexed Sudetenland and occupied Czech Republic, they also installed a puppet government in Slovakia. And the leader of the Slovak government was a man called Joseph Tiso. He was a Roman Catholic priest. He was a big anti-Semite, and he surrounded himself with extremists and nationalists in the government and immediately started the persecution of Jews. But also, Tiso was the first one to sympathize with the fascist regime in Germany, and therefore also joined the German-Japanese axis, which gave him the reason that Slovakia, in fact, was not occupied while the rest of Europe was occupied. But the anti-Semitic propaganda and accusation of anything that happened wrong in Slovakia, always the Jews were blamed. And finally, the Slovak government introduced a Jewish codex, which contained 270 paragraphs. And I have a newspaper of the time, it was in 1941, September, and I have a page from the newspaper, just give you a feeling what happened in Slovakia. And I read a couple of the headlines. Our roads are exemplary for the whole of Europe, last all for the Jews. The superiority of the Slovak race is guaranteed above the Jewish race. The strictest racial laws against Jews are Slovak. In certain aspects, the Slovak anti-Jewish laws are stricter than the German ones, and so on. And you can see also a caricature which shows a book of laws, and the Jews are falling out, and the Jew is looking upwards, meaning that no longer the law applies to the Jews. In fact, in these laws, we the Jews were prohibited to go to any public places, park, cinema, swimming pool, theaters. We had to wear a yellow star from the age of 5 when we left the house. We were not allowed to go to national school. We were practically ostracized from the Slovak society. We had no legal protection. And of course, after headlines like this, there were pogroms in Slovakia. Many synagogues were burned down. Jews were beaten up on the street, and some even died during this pogrom. Many properties were damaged, of course, without any redress. In 1941, I was 6 years old and the age to start school. But because I was Jewish, I couldn't go to the national school in the village. Therefore, I was sent to a neighboring town, Nitra, where there was still a big Jewish community, about 5,000, and there were a lot of Jewish schools. And I remember my first day when I went to the school, because of course I had to wear a yellow star. If I have it here, again. I had to wear it because I went out, I'm a 6 year old, and I had to put it on my left side. It was about that size, and in the middle was written Jude, Jew. And of course, when children were coming opposite me without the yellow star, in other words, not Jewish children, they would shout at me, "You smelly Jew, you dirty Jew, you pig Jew." I was only 6 years old, so I would run. The school was only about 300 yards from where we lived. But if I come near to them, they would spit at me, so I have to run to the other side of the road so that I'm not beaten up. And this was really the first time that I realized that I'm different to the other children, because we were sheltered, even though all this was going on, my parents wouldn't talk about it, they wouldn't tell me. And so the first time I experienced this hatred against Jews, of course I didn't understand why. But as the time was going on, the German, they asked the Slovaks that they need some help to help in the war effort, and they asked for some volunteer from Slovakia to come to work in Germany. Unfortunately, not many Slovak people volunteered for this work, and the extremists saw at that time the opportunity how to get rid of the Jews, and they suggested to Germany, "What about if we send you a slave labor, the young men and women, to Jewish young men and women, and you could use them?" And they sent a delegation, and they agreed to do this. And so in 1942, in March, the first arrest started in Slovakia. And of course, the first people to be arrested were young men and young women. And the first transport started in March. The transport continued till October. But the Slovaks immediately realized that if they sent all the young men and women, Jewish young men and women, they will be left with the families to look after, the mothers, the children, the old people. And so they approached the German again, the Slovak government, because, as I said, Slovakia was not occupied by Germany. It was the Slovak government that approached again the German and said, "What about you taking all of them, not only the young people?" And they met Adolf Eichmann and Himmler in Berlin, and they reached an agreement. The agreement consisted of two very important paragraphs. One was that the Slovak will pay for every Jew 500 mark that will be deported from Slovakia. They called this so-called settlement cost. In other words, the people will have to be fed and clothed and taught a profession until they can look after themselves, and therefore the Slovak government should pay for every Jew that the German take. Of course, it was all a lie. It nearly bankrupt the Slovak nation. The second paragraph was that before any Jews are taken out of Slovakia, they have to be stripped of their Slovak citizenship. And this was a very important paragraph for the German, because it meant the moment the Jews left Slovakia, left the border, no longer the Slovak government any legal write what will happen to these people. And we know, of course, what happened. This transport continued unabated till October. Every transport, about 1,000 and 1,500 Jews. And during these 7 months, more than 50 transport left. About 58,000 Jews were deported. And according to the statistic after the war, out of these 58,000 Jews that were deported, only 282 people survived. During this time, I lost 35 members of my family. But when the transport started, of course, I was recalled from the town immediately because it was very dangerous for me to stay there in case I will be arrested. So I was brought to the village. My father got exemption at the time because at the time the people that were transported were mostly people that were not useful to the Slovak economy, small shopkeepers, government employees, people that didn't contribute to the Slovak economy. Because my father was a farmer, he was considered as contributing to the economy, and therefore, for the time being, we were not taken away. However, my education at the time consisted only of 4 months, and the next time when I went to school was end of 1945, beginning 1946. So my education beginning was only of 4 months. But in August, 29th of August 1944, there was an uprising in Slovakia, and it happened in Banská Bystrica, in other words, the Slovak nation rebelled against the fascist regime, because not only the Jews suffered under the Tiso regime, it was also the Slovaks. If they had different political identity, or they were talking about something that they shouldn't against the government, they were being arrested and never seen again. So, in 29th of August 1944, the Slovak nation rose against the Tiso regime. Because the Slovak government did not have a big army, they asked, and they had a pact with Germany. Tiso approached Hitler and asked him to send the German army to Slovakia, in other words, to occupy Slovakia and suppress this uprising. So in fact, Slovakia, for the first time, was occupied in August 1944. It was not invaded, it was actually invited to occupy the Slovakia. Unfortunately, with the German army, also a unit of Adolf Eichmann arrived, and that meant doom for the Slovak Jews that still were left in Slovakia. There were about 25,000 still left. Among them, of course, we were. Now, we, of course, had to do something about our position as well, because even though in our village many people were protecting us, again, it put them at great danger, because they were still going arrest even though transports were not happening, and many times we had to hide in houses of our friends, and like in Vilna, it was also in Slovakia, that these people, if they were caught hiding Jews, they would have been very severely punished. Yet there were people that were prepared to help us. But once the German occupied Slovakia, we knew that they worked very efficiently and we wouldn't survive for very long in the village because we didn't know who was our friend and who was our enemy. But the first thing what we had to do is to obtain a false paper, because with a name like Reichenthal, of course, if we were stopped by the Gestapo on the street, they would have known. Or we were German, or we were Jews. Of course, we were not German. They would have known right away that we were Jews. In the village, the priest of the village was a good friend of my family, of my parents. They used to socialize together. My parents used to visit him, and they used to play cards in the evening and have a social drink. So he was very good friend and very sympathetic to our cause, and he promised that he would get us false paper, which he got by somebody that died many years in the village. And I remember the name was Vida, so my name was Thomas Vida. So it was a very typical Slovak name. Also because we decided to leave the village. We as children, my brother and myself, would have to go to a national school, and we will have to pretend that we were not Jews, that we were Catholic. And so we went to the priest, and he used to teach us all the prayers and about the station of the cross, about how to cross ourselves, how to pray. Then when we were in the school, that people will not suspect that we were Jewish. But with all our effort, whatever we did, of course the Gestapo was very, very efficient, and eventually we were caught. First of all, we left the village, and my father was left behind and wanted, because he had to look after the farm, and he said, I will be okay. We left for Bratislava. But a couple of days later, we heard my father was arrested. It was actually a man from the village that he betrayed my father, and we thought we would never see him again. But as it happened, when he was being transported to Auschwitz, he managed to escape. He managed to jump from the train. They broke the lock on the cattle car, and he jumped out and he saved himself and went up to the mountain where he joined the partisan, the resistance army, the Slovak resistance army, and he fought with them till end of the war, and so he survived. We were caught in Bratislava. It was 16th of October 1944, and basically the Gestapo, my grandmother was betrayed, and when my mother went there, they discovered that she was the mother of my mother, my grandmother, and on that day 13 of us were apprehended. My grandmother was beaten up, she was 76. They knew that somebody must be supporting her. The Gestapo beat her, and she betrayed her son and daughter, my aunt and uncles. And as I said, on the day, 13 of us were arrested. We were brought to the Gestapo headquarters in Bratislava, and from there we were brought to a detention camp in Slovakia, Seret. Seret was a center place from where the transport were then taken to the east, mainly to Lublin and to Auschwitz, where of course all the Jews, within a very short period, perished. But this, of course, in 1944, the transport again began, and in Seret they conducted the selection. I don't know if you know what selection meant, but it was the cruelest way to separate the children from the father, the mother from their husband. In other words, we would be brought to a roll court, and a man called Alois Brunner, who was there, who was doing this selection, he had the life of everybody in his heart. And he would say, the old people go to one side with the children, the young people to the other side. In other words, one group to die and one group to live. As it happened, my aunt and uncles, they were sent to Buchenwald concentration camp, which was a slave labor camp. The inmates, they worked in stone quarries, and the life expectancy in this camp was about 2 months. Out of the 13, seven of my uncles and aunts went to Buchenwald. Six of them perished. Only one cousin, he was 15 years old, he survived. We were taken on the 2nd November. November, we were put into cattle cars. It was only a straw on the floor in the middle of the carriage. There was a palm served as a toilet and a couple of buckets. And the door closed behind us, and we were traveling for 7 days. In fact, from one day to the next, from civilized life, suddenly we became like cattle. The condition deteriorated very quickly. During the day, the train would be standing on some sidelines because the German, the Slovak and the German, they didn't want to show what was happening to the Jews, and during the night the train would be traveling. The stench was unbearable, people were crying. In fact, one of the people died in the carriage, and we were traveling like this for 7 days. Occasionally the door would open, they would take the barrel out, empty it, and they would give us some water and food. On the 7th day, it was 9th of November 1944, middle of the night, the carriage opened, and we were greeted, we shout, raus, raus, schnell, schnell. We had to jump out very quickly. Of course, we were very worried about my grandmother, she was 76. And we were put in rows and marched during the night. It was raining, very, very cold in November. And till we were greeted with searchlights, and we arrived to a gate which opened. We walked in, we were soaked and soiled from the ground and from the rain and dirt, because we didn't go on the main road. We were walking to the forest, and it was a dreadful way. Of course, the Alsatian dog on its side with the SS, and they were prompting us with their weapon, schnell, schnell. So we were all the time worried about my grandmother. After 2.5 hours, we arrived into the camp, and we were put into a block. There were bunk beds, three beds, the one above the other. We put our head down. In minutes, we didn't even realize, hardly slept. We heard raus, raus, schnell, and we went to a roll call, and we were told that we were in Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Bergen-Belsen is about 70 kilometers north of Hanover. It was a POW camp, prisoner of war camp. Mainly Russian and Polish soldiers were brought there, and they had to build a camp under very cold weather, and many of them perished from starvation and disease. But in 1943, the German government decided to convert the camp to establish a detention camp for Jews, to hold about 25,000 Jews. Many Jews camped there from Poland and Russia and Holland, Dutch Jews, mainly from the diamond industry, And they kept these people for the purpose of exchanging them for their own soldier in the Allied hand. So the camp was divided into several sections. Some of the sections were Star prisoners, in other words, the more important prisoner, politician, people that they could exchange for their own people in the Allied hand. Bergen-Belsen was not an extermination camp in the sense that there were gas chambers, there was a crematoria there, but it was used only for dead people, corpses, because of course the Germans didn't want to leave anybody there, any corpses that somebody saw what was happening. But when we arrived there in November 1944, already Bergen-Belsen was in a grip of starvation and disease, mainly typhoid. What we saw there was hell on earth. We saw people just skin and bone. To describe how these people looked was, if we just take a skeleton and imagine that we put a rubber balloon over. That's how these people looked. They were just the bones were protruding. It was a sight like from hell. We saw these prisoners just walking very, very slowly because they were very, very weak. Occasionally they would fall down, never to get up again. In other words, we saw people in front of our eyes die. It was December when we received a new commander. His name was Joseph Kramer. He came from Auschwitz. He was a cruel man, and the punishments that was being given out was beating, and immediately the portion of food was reduced, and people started to suffer even more than before. Our food that we used to get would be for breakfast, for morning, a cup of coffee, which was black water, with two slices of bread. And for lunch, we got a beet boiled in water. In other words, when we ate a meal, we were hungry. When we got the next meal, we were still hungry. We were not hungry for a day, not for a week. We were hungry for months. So you can imagine a person's thought, and all the time was when the next meal will come. And we were, of course, starving. But the other people, they even starved even more. But in January, Auschwitz had to be evacuated because the Red Army was advancing. And therefore, the people from Auschwitz and other camp in the east were brought to Germany. And in Bergen-Belsen, the population in January suddenly grew from 25,000 to over 65,000. In this amount of people, in such a small place, the typhoid became rampant. People were dying in hundreds and thousands. Whereas before, every morning, these women, two women, would come with a cart and they would come to the block and ask if anybody died, and if anybody died, they would take the corpse out and take it out. And in the evening, all these corpses would be taken from the mortuary to the crematorium and burned. But once this amount of people started to die in January, in February, no longer the crematorium could cope. And therefore the corpses were just thrown out front of the blocks. And these piles were growing from day to day. In fact, they grew to about 4 feet high, as far as the eye could see. There were thousands, and these corpses were decomposing and rotting away. So you can imagine the stench that was coming from these corpses. But we, as children, we used to play there and run around and play. We didn't even notice this stench. This was our surrounding. and this is how we live there. The amount of people dying reached the amount of February and March per month, 17,000 people died. In fact, in 2 months, 34,000 people died. And all these corpses were just thrown out in front of the blocks. People were starving, and of course the disease, they got diarrhea, they got dehydrated, finally they couldn't collect their food and eventually died. The death was a very slow, very painful death. And many people wanted to escape from this death. So they would, during the night, they would run towards the barbed wire. They would start to climb the barbed wire and they would be shot. And in the morning, we would see 6-7 corpses just in our section every morning. This was a daily occurrence. We used to hear these shots being fired during the night and we used to see these people on the barbed wire hanging and had to be taken down. They knew that they can't escape, but they just wanted to escape the suffering that they were going through. It was 7th of March that I saw my mother and aunt were crying, and I was asking, what happened? And they told me my grandmother passed away. So again this morning, these two women come with their car and ask if anybody died. And they come to the room. One took my grandmother by the hand, one by the feet. They threw her on the car, and then she was carted out and then thrown on the pile of corpses outside. And this was the last time I saw my grandmother. It was 11th of April when suddenly we didn't see any guards on the watchtowers, and we knew something was happening. For 4 days we didn't get any water or food, and on the 15th of April we heard this rumbling coming through the middle of the camp, tanks and lorries, so we all ran towards the middle of the camp to the barbed wire to see what was happening. In one of the jeeps that was going was a journalist, Richard Dimbleby, and he filmed the entry to Bergen-Belsen. In fact, that film was the first film that reached the West, and the West saw for the first time what was happening in this concentration camp. So at the time, Bergen-Belsen became more notorious, in fact, than Auschwitz. And we saw this film later in the years, and we recorded it on a video machine, and we took frame by frame to see when children were on the barbed wire if you can recognize anybody. And this is one of the pictures, and there in the middle, that's my brother. So this is the moment, you can see the barbed wire there. We were at the barbed wire, it was 15th of April, about 11 o'clock in the morning, 1945, and that's the moment we were liberated. So this is a little memento from our liberation. I also here a picture of to show you how dehumanized we were at the time. You can see here a group of women sitting and they're cooking and they're laughing. This is just, of course, after the liberation. And here behind it's all the corpses, they're decomposing. This is in April, it was already warm. So the stench that must have been coming out of them. And they are eating here and joking, and only a couple of feet behind them are all these corpses. I have also here a little witness description. It is officer giving, preparing the medical team before they were going into the camp, is preparing them to what they're going to encounter. So I'm going to read it to you. The next morning, 17th of April, on a parade, our commanding officer addressed us. He had visited the horror camp and corroborated the rumor. It is unbelievable, he said. There is no organization, no food, nothing. Half-starved, emaciated, spiritless, demented, these people roaming the camp have been reduced to animal level. I went to the women's quarter of the camp hospital. It was only about 100 yards from where we were. Many of them are stark naked, are literally crawling about on their hands and knees, too weak to walk. Their bedding, just skin and bone, lying their own dung. In one small room were 40 women, few with any clothes, huddled together to keep warm. Some of them had been dead for days. Nobody had come to dispose of their body. I have seen some sight. I thought I could take anything, but this shook me, made me vomit. Outside, the dead are piled 4 feet high over a large area. Bulldozers are having to be employed to shovel these bodies into large pit. I could tell you more, even worse, but it's too sick to talk about. This was Bergen-Belsen. I have also a letter here that Reverend Morrison, he was a chaplain in the British Army, and he came with the Liberation Army into Bergen-Belsen. He wrote his letter to his sister in Ballysimon, County Limerick. I'm not going to read you the whole letter, but just a couple of lines, the scale of what happened there. So far, I have buried 15,000, and I have not been able to attend all funerals, as I consider the dying more important than the dead. Those 15,000 did not take up much of my time, as 10 graves held up to 5,000 bodies each. He said 15,000, it didn't take much of his time. I was at the burial a couple of days later. It took a whole morning, and he buried in a very short time 15,000. Joseph Tissot, he was sentenced to death in April in 1947. He was tried by the Slovaks and he was hung. Kramer, his 12 others, were also executed not far from Bergen-Belsen. Out of a population of 90,000 Slovak Jews, only 12,000 survived. As Lynn mentioned, I never talked about my experiences for over 55 years, but I decided to talk about it because I'm one of the last witnesses to this horror that happened not long ago. And I speak to young people because I think I owe it to the victims that the memory is not forgotten. And I hope that these young people will carry this memory for another generation, and they will tell the story to their children and tell the story also, so it will be carried for more generations. I want to finish with a little poem which is very appropriate to this lecture. The horror of Holocaust is not that it deviated from the human norms. The horror is that it didn't. What happened might happen again to others, not necessarily Jews, perpetrated by others, not necessarily Germans. We are all possible victims, possible perpetrators, possible bystanders. Thank you for your patience.